This holiday, BMW has reunited three members of the family at the BMW Roadhome Sales Event. The Agile X3, engineered for any adventure. The plug-in hybrid X5, commanding the streets with unmatched presence. And the all-electric i4, charging into the future with impeccable performance. Hurry in to find what powers your journey at the BMW Roadhome Sales Event. BMW, the ultimate driving machine.
Hurry in for exceptional offers through December 2nd. Visit BMWUSA.com for details.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
It's better over here.
AT&T customers, switching to T-Mobile has never been easier. We'll pay off your existing phone and give you a new one free. All on America's largest 5G network. Visit T-Mobile.com/carrierfreedom to switch today.
Payoff up to $650 via virtual prepaid MasterCard in 15 days. Free phone up to $830 via 24 monthly bill credits plus tax. Qualifying port-in trade-in service on Go5G Next and credit required. Contact us before canceling entire account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance and required finance agreement is due.
Welcome back, folks. We are joined by Rafael Goyeneche, President, Metropolitan Crime Commission. He joins us on Thursday every week, actually an hour earlier today, and we appreciate the accommodation. Rafi, welcome to the show.
Hey, my pleasure, Neil. How are you? I love the cool weather, huh? Beautiful.
Oh, man, it is gorgeous this morning for sure. Let's jump right into this, Rafi. I know you've been following the numbers as it relates to shootings, gun arrests, and the like. What impact has constitutional carry had with gun enforcement thus far?
Well, so constitutional carry became law in Louisiana on July the 4th. It didn't go into effect in Orleans Parish until August. So since August, you know, one of the most important tools that law enforcement used over the last couple of years to reduce violent crime is concealed carry enforcement. So that tool went away, and I wanted to see what the impact of that tool was. So I asked my staff to run some numbers for me. And what we saw between January and June, there were, on average, 80 gun arrests per month before constitutional carry went into effect. Since constitutional carry went into effect, it's down to 44 gun arrests a month. So what does that mean? Well, we continue to see violent crime decrease. And it's not because the police just wrung their hands and said, you know, we can't do anything about people carrying concealed weapons anymore. What they did was they pivoted from gun enforcement to narcotics enforcement. So I've run the numbers to determine the arrests that have been made so far this year. And one of the tools that was being underutilized, but is being utilized, I think, in response largely to the constitutional carry legislation, is narcotics enforcement. And there's a connection between narcotics, guns, and violence. So the police used to be able to look for the outline of a concealed weapon, and that would give them the predication to go up to a suspect and ask them if they had a permit. If the answer was no, they could begin to make the arrest. And they found out that about 60% of those misdemeanor gun stops evolved into felony weapons arrest. So that tool is gone, but law enforcement just didn't say, well, we can't do anything about it. It's critically important that law enforcement not wait for someone to dial 911. They have to include proactive policing in their repertoire of combating crime in this or any community. So what we've seen is that there were 506 drug charge arrest that uncovered weapons. So 57% of the drug arrests have yielded weapon arrests as well, meaning that the person that they saw distributing drugs or using drugs, they either had a firearm and they were a convicted felon in possession of a firearm, that firearm, and you cannot possess a firearm while you are using drugs. If that firearm is stolen when they make that drug arrest, they can check the firearm to determine if it's been linked to any other unsolved crimes. So what you're seeing is that law enforcement, both the NOPD and LSP, a large part of their proactive strategies now have shifted from strictly gun enforcement to narcotics enforcement. So I checked some stats from the French Quarter, and the French Quarter relied very, very heavily on officers on foot looking at the people on foot in the French Quarter. If they see the outline of the weapon under their clothing, that gave them the justification to go up to them and make those arrests. So a large number of guns were taken off the street in the French Quarter. So in the 8th District, in 2023, there were 381 guns seized between January and December for the year. So far this year, through mid-November, there are 174. So you're seeing gun seizures down by 50% in the French Quarter. Hmm. So in the French Quarter, what the 8th District is doing is there's a robust camera network in the French Quarter. And the Louisiana State Police and the NOPD both have invested in creating monitoring banks of TVs in their respective headquarters in the French Quarter. Because of the camera network, they can observe the drug deals going down in the French Quarter. When they go out to investigate and make an arrest, a large number of those drug arrests are yielding the recovery of firearms. So, you know, in addition to they have video of the drug transactions going on, they're also finding that 50% in the French Quarter of those narcotics arrests are going to have guns on them. So we're seeing how law enforcement is shifting their policies because of the shift in the law. And they're continuing to, you know, drive down crime across the city. But it's a different, you know, again, there's trade-offs with everything. And what we're seeing is that because of the legislature and changing and allowing constitutional carry, it's forced law enforcement to change their strategies. So far, so good. But, you know, there were several issues and, you know, brought up with respect to the second line parade shooting, mass shooting, and double homicide on Sunday. And I think Oliver Thomas commented publicly that a number of people in the crowd were supposedly carrying concealed weapons. Now, you cannot carry a concealed weapon along a parade route. But again, I've seen pictures of the crowd and a lot of people there, and there were about 100 officers, but it still didn't prevent that tragedy or those tragedies, two separate, supposedly unrelated instances of a mass shooting along the parade route and then a double homicide along the parade route within 45 minutes of each other. So, again, it's a problem, but law enforcement is working their way through that problem.
Well, what you described, though, is actually encouraging, right? I mean, they're nimble. The one constant is they continue to be proactive, and proactive policing is going to yield a multitude of things. right? Whether it be the gun, the drug, or some other violations. To selectively incapacitate impact criminals, what the charge ultimately is, my approach always was, is of no moment. It's just as long as we get that individual off the street. And if they're out there dealing drugs or doing this or doing that, I really didn't care what charges we had on them, as long as we got them off the street and in jail. And that we were able to derive and collect street-level intelligence from these individuals so that we could continue to connect dots out there and utilize that intelligence to help formulate our strategies in multitudes of geographic regions, because these geographic regions present different challenges. The makeup's a little different. Some might be loosely connected folks. Some may be a little bit more organized. I don't want to say that they were a gang, but, you know, working together. It's amazing how some stay in a lane of certain violations, criminal violations, and don't deviate from it much. It's hard to believe, but they do. But as long as you're proactive and you're out there, you're going to collect information that's going to reveal a lot of what's the underbelly of whatever piece of geography you're policing. So I think that this is very encouraging to me, that they're nimble.
It is.
And they're still out there beating the bushes, trying to find crimes, right?
And they're not waiting for someone to dial 911. You know, they're using their training. They're using technology to identify felony offenders. And when they observe it, you know, they're using their authority to engage, and they're making significant arrests. And as a result of that, we continue to see crime going down, because the offenders that they're arresting, many of them have extensive criminal histories. When you take those guns out of commerce that are being used by felony offenders and you arrest those felony offenders, it is making crime not just in that location but all over the city, because many of the criminals are looking for opportunities, and one day it may be in the 8th district, and the next day it could be in the 7th district. So they're, when they make an arrest, it's making the entire city safer for everybody. And these strategies are, in fact, working.
You and I remember the day that officers were apologizing for being proactive. And thankfully, that culture and that, you know, ideology is gone. Right? I mean, how frustrating was that?
I mean, the byproduct of that is the crime we saw skyrocket, you know, during COVID, 20, 21, 22. And we largely stopped doing proactive policing in 2020, and we didn't return to it to the last quarter of 2022. So 2022 was the high water mark for crime in this city. And in 2023, proactive policing was now an important part of the police department's plan to address crime. And that has continued. Crime came down in 2023. It has come down in 2024. And now the state police are heavily leaning into proactive policing, because they're not the first responders. When people call 911, a state trooper is not being deployed, an NOPD officer is being deployed. The troopers are engaging in proactive policing all over the city, not just the French Quarter. Now, what they're using in other parts of the city is traffic enforcement, traffic stops. And they're not just issuing tickets to make money. They are using traffic stops as a strategy to identify potential felony offenders. So when they see and they know that many of the certain parts of town that the offenders involved are in late model vehicles with tinted windows and are, you know, relatively high horsepower cars, they see a traffic violation, they pull them over. I saw, you know, some stats that were shared with me by the LSP a few weeks ago. They made one day, they made 41 traffic stops. but they only issued 9 citations. The other 33 people that were pulled over for traffic, they let go with a warning because there was nothing else, you know, wrong with that stop. But the 9 citations that they issued were issued to 6 people that were arrested for felony offenses. So those traffic pullovers, they identified that some of those people were wanted. They observed drugs and guns, convicted felon in possession of a firearm, a stolen vehicle. And that was just in the 7th District. So what you're seeing is when they start to do those strategies and the NOPD is doing traffic enforcement and other high crime areas in and around, you know, the city, it is allowing the police to be more effective in continuing their mission to reduce crime. So if you're just letting that traffic offender go, you're missing the opportunity to make a significant arrest. And if all it is someone with a broken taillight, they let them go with a warning. They're not trying to make money off of this deal. They're trying to use their skills and their training to identify felony offenders. And if they don't find a felony offender, they're usually going to let them go with a warning.
Yeah. You mentioned the pandemic years, and we were, I guess, fortunate to an extent where some people really wanted to get to a deeper place, that we really didn't binge drink this defund the police Kool-Aid, you know, that was running across this country. We probably swallowed about half the glass, and then we realized, you know, hold the horses, this may not be what we want to do, right?
Right, right. I mean, we're still, you know, because of the pandemic, you know, and because of the George Floyd, you know, movement, you saw a lot of people leave law enforcement. And because of the pandemic, it was tough to recruit people. And because of George Floyd and, you know, the national backlash, a lot of people that may have considered being police didn't want to be the police at that point in time. We're still struggling with those numbers. I mean, right now as we speak, you know, on paper, there were a little bit south of 900 officers. In reality, that says that we're probably closer to 800 than we are to 900, because at any given time, you've got about 100 people that, in that force that are either running out their time, they're on military
vacation,
duty,
sick leave,
or whatever. So, you know, how is the police department with 800 officers able to bring down crime the way they have the past 2 years? And it's because of proactive policing. They're being a lot more strategic and precise and following the data, following the intelligence, and being selective in how they use their resources. And, you know, just look at the inmate population in, you know, parish prison, the OJC. You're looking at 1,540-some-odd pretrial inmates right now. 66% of them are in there for felony crimes of violence or felony weapon offenses. And the third that are in there for property and drugs have extensive criminal records as well, so including crimes of violence in their criminal histories. So the fact that we have 1,544 people off the streets is a testament to the good work that's being done by the NOPD and the Louisiana State Police, and the support that those two agencies are receiving from the District Attorney's Office in New Orleans and the Attorney General's Office for the state of Louisiana as well.
No doubt. Got to get to a break. We're visiting with Rafael Goyeneche, President of the Metropolitan Crime Commission. We'll be right back, folks. Stay with us.
For the past 3 seasons of Gone South, we've covered one story per season. Now, Gone South is back for a 4th season. But this time, we're doing things a little differently. In Gone South Season 4, we'll be bringing you new stories every week with no end in sight. Listen to and follow Gone South, an Odyssey original podcast, on the free Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.
Well, Welcome back, folks. We're visiting with Rafael Goyeneche, president of the Metropolitan Crime Commission. Rafi, the head of New Orleans DA Civil Rights Division, resigns. That's Emily Ma from the DA's office here recently. Tell us about it.
Well, so Emily Ma was hired by Jason Williams to head up a newly created Civil Rights Division. So the whole thought process there was that they wanted to determine if there were any wrongful convictions or unjust convictions that were obtained in Orleans Parish. So they created an in-house Civil Rights Division to address that. And she was working closely with the Criminal Defense Bar and some of the private nonprofits that represent offenders. So I think part of the problem philosophically that I had with that is that, I'm all for the district attorney's office complying with legal requests and looking at convictions. And if they uncover any wrongdoing, it's their responsibility to report it to the court and address that. But, you know, what we saw emerge over there, and we first saw Emily Ma, or at least a large part of the community saw Emily Ma, when back in February of 23, I came on your show and talked about what happened on Mardi Gras Day in magistrate court, where Emily Ma covered the arrests that were made by the police department. I believe that particular day there were about 13 gun arrests that made their first appearance in magistrate court at Mardi Gras of 23. And Emily Ma is supposed to be there representing the state and addressing and informing the court of the facts of the case and advocating for bail. What Emily Ma did on Mardi Gras Day in 2023 was something that I had never seen a prosecutor do before, and I worked as a prosecutor. And what she did is she went into magistrate court with the purpose of that is to set bail, and she refused charges against all of the gun arrests that were made before a police report was submitted. Before any information, that wasn't her responsibility to do that. You have a screening division, you give the police the ability and the time to get their police reports in, but she went into court and dismissed all of those cases and allowed individuals that were convicted felons in possession of a firearm to get out of jail for free. And one of those cases that we found out about involved her stopping or at least releasing an individual that the police department stopped in the French Quarter for having a fully automatic weapon. And we referred that case to the U.S. Attorney's Office. They adopted it and obtained a conviction, and he went to the penitentiary. Well, Emily Ma went back to her duties in working in the Civil Rights Division. And it was disclosed when she left that there were 300 people that she helped vacate the convictions or reduce sentences for, on. 300 people. Now, I believe that there was some wrongdoing with respect to either police or prosecutor investigations, but I can assure you there weren't 300 cases that rose to that level. And what Emily Ma, the judgment that she used in magistrate court on Mardi Gras Day of 2023, I believe that what she did on Mardi Gras Day of 2023 should have been justification for termination. And if she exhibited that type of poor judgment in magistrate court in February of 2023, I think that everything that she handled in the Civil Rights Division needs to be audited and reviewed. And that audit and review is underway now by the Louisiana Senate that has a committee looking into that, as well as the Attorney General's office. that is reviewing many or all of the cases that have been handled. I'm not sure, but I know that they are reviewing a number of those cases. So essentially, if a sentence was vacated or conviction was vacated and the DA agreed to a reduced sentence, and it wasn't because of some procedural or wrongful or misconduct on the part of the prosecution or the police. Essentially, what the DA's office is doing and what Emily Ma is doing is granting clemency. Clemency is not the prerogative of the district attorney's office. That belongs, according to the Constitution of Louisiana, with the executive branch of government, which is the governor. The governor has the right to grant clemency. But what we're going to see, I think, as this audit and this review that's underway, you're going to see, I think, examples of cases where the DA's office granted reduced sentences or vacated convictions to people that procedurally and factually were guilty. But the DA's office and Emily Ma believe that they had paid their debt to society. And I think that the reason that she left is there was a law that was changed in this most recent session. And she and the DA's office no longer has the unilateral authority to do this. And now, because of this legislation, it limits the district attorney's office to do it. And it also requires that the attorney general's office be informed and be allowed to review all of the post-conviction relief requests that are being processed within every district attorney's office. So Emily Ma is not going to have the freedom to do what she did the past 4 years, and I suspect that that was one of the main reasons, if not the reason, that she elected to resign, and that disclosure was made last Friday. I don't know how she survive beyond the February of 2023. And if she utilized the judgment in the Civil Rights Division that she exhibited in magistrate court on Mardi Gras Day of 2023, I have some real concerns about some of the cases that she handled. And we'll have to wait and see how the investigation and reviews that are being conducted by the Senate and the Attorney General's office plays out.
Rafi, I mean, what is the remedial action to this? I mean, how does someone like this, let's assume that the powers that she utilized, the power of the office inappropriately, was really more like a clemency than anything else, no procedural deficiencies or otherwise, or any legal deficiencies. Shouldn't somebody like this lose their law license? I mean, you're acting with intentionality. You know, or you should, that you don't have the authority to do this. You're just promoting your own personal beliefs and ideologies.
Right. I mean, could the Bar Association begin, or the Office of Professional Responsibility for Attorneys that governs attorneys under the Code of Professional Conduct, could they conduct an investigation? Yes. Can they, are they? I have no idea. I think that, depending on what is found, there could be matters that are referred to the Office of Professional Conduct, that governs the licensing of attorneys. But, I think there are also a number of other potential conflicts that Emily Ma may have overlooked. So when she was hired, she was working for nonprofits that were defending and representing many of the people that she was responsible for now initiating on behalf of the DA's office, a procedural or wrongful conviction filing in court. So if she or the firm that she was working with defending the offenders are now cases that she's overseeing in her capacity as an assistant district attorney working in the Civil Rights Division, I believe that that's potentially a conflict of interest, and a conflict of interest that no one has looked into in this. And I'm hoping that that's part of the review that's underway right now to see if there were, in fact, any conflicts where the organization that she was working for before she went to work for the DA's office, if she oversaw any cases involving that organization's clients that she was making decisions on. I think that that is an inherent conflict of interest. No one knows the extent of that or whether there are any or how many violations there could possibly be. But I certainly think that's something that needs to be looked into.
Absolutely. All right, we got to get to a break. We're visiting with Rafael Goyeneche, president of the Metropolitan Crime Commission. Breaking news, former Congressman Matt Gaetz says that he will no longer seek to be confirmed as Attorney General, saying that the controversy surrounding his potential nomination was unfairly becoming a distraction to President-elect Donald Trump's agenda. Matt Gaetz out as it relates to being confirmed for Attorney General. We'll be right back, folks. Stay with us. Welcome back, folks. We're visiting with Rafael Goyeneche, president of the Metropolitan Crime Commission. Rafi, just recently, over the past week or so, we've had these terrorizing incidents at schools. It kind of mystifying to me that just all of a sudden, out of the blue, bam, we decided we're going to do this.
Right. I think what you're seeing is a lot of this is social media driven. You know, where kids, I think, now are copycatting, you know, the threats. So we're seeing this thing explode. Just yesterday, Abramson was closed. And then I got in this morning and saw that they were closed a second day because a new threat came in this morning. So this is, you know, you're going to have the police chief on, and she can talk about, you know, what how this is impacting the NOPD. But I think that it's also important to understand, and the only way that this is going to stop is that the people that are doing this have to be, you know, have to pay a consequence for doing it. So the police are going to do their job, but once they make an arrest, then the case goes to the district attorney's office. So when the arrest is made, and there have been six kids that have been arrested, none of them have prior histories, I'm told. You know, of the six kids that are arrested, four of them are female, two of them are male. They range from age 11 to age 15. And so a lot of these kids think that this is cute, this is fun, it's harmless. Well, it's anything but that, because terrorizing is a felony. Now, because of their age, they'll be handled in juvenile court. But the DA's office has the ability to decide what to charge offenders with. So they may be booked by the police department, which is terrorizing, which what this is that's exactly what they did when they call in a school and issue a threat. Even though it's likely a hoax, you cannot assume that it is a hoax. You have to take every threat as a serious tip. And when you shut down the school, you know, you're disrupting the curriculum of not just that student that doesn't want to go to school. You're shutting down the whole school. Hundreds, if not thousands, of kids have missed school because of 20 different threats that have come in over the past 9 days. And, you know, that not only impacts the police department, but it impacts the school. It impacts the parents that have sent their children to those schools. And it impacts the district attorney's office and the juvenile justice system. So when those six kids were arrested, they got booked into the JJIC, which is the juvenile holding facility. There's only 76 beds that are available there. As we speak today, 72 of those beds are occupied. And two of the six children that were arrested are still in pretrial custody there. And the ones that are being released are receiving additional support services from the juvenile justice system in the form of counseling, where they're being deployed to the kids' families, and trying to determine, you know, if there are any issues with the families. So there's extreme costs in all of this. There's a provision in state law that allows the district attorney's office to attempt to charge someone with the false threat of harm at a school. It allows the district attorney's office to make the responsible person have to pay for the cost and any expenses incurred in the emergency response. So when you factor in the NOPD's efforts in all of this, every one of these cases has to be investigated. They can't just dismiss it. So at a time when we're still trying to drive down crime, these threats have to be, are taking resources from the police department, from the district attorney's office, from the juvenile justice system, and that's costing taxpayers money.
Yeah.
So the DA could charge the families with responsibility of reimbursing the system for the cost of these prank calls, and that could be devastating to the families involved. So parents need to put their foot down and make sure that their children understand that there is going to be a severe consequence for this type of misconduct.
I watched the press conference with the chief, and it was obvious to me that she was visibly irritated with this kind of, you know, shits and giggles, shenanigans going on by these kids, right? I mean, because as you said, the disruption, you know, to the learning environment, you know, yet you're going to have to take some time to rebuild that. And then opportunity loss for NOPD because they're all wrapped up in these multitude of investigations and multitude of locations. I mean, what a pain in the neck. I mean, it's the first time I've actually really, I don't know about you, seen her that visibly irritated with something.
Well, right. You know, and again, you know, we talked about, you know, the manpower crisis of the police department. And the police department is doing more with less. So they will, you know, they're more than willing to deal with legitimate crime issues as they emerge. And, you know, this is impeding the police department's ability to use their scarce resources in a more effective way because they cannot ignore these types of threats. You never know when one of these you know, threats are legitimate. So they all are treated seriously. They're all treated as real threats. And, you know, what we found is fortunately none of them worth real. And it's pranks. And it's basically, you know, become, I guess, the ploy of the moment to get out of going to school, to get a free vacation day in the middle of a week. And kids think that it's cute, but when they start to see what, you know, the consequences are, and this needs to be publicized, that this isn't just about getting out of school. Now you are possibly facing expulsion. You're exposing your family to having to pay for the cost of the response by law enforcement. And you may, in fact, be convicted of a juvenile offense that, you know, I don't expect you'll go to the juvenile jail, but I think that you'll probably be on probation and be under supervision for a large part of the next couple of school years if you're convicted of doing this.
Absolutely. And thankfully, the investigators did a great job bringing this to a quick conclusion as well. Got to get to a break. Thank you so much, Raphael Goinecci, president of the Metropolitan Crime Commission. Always appreciate your time and your insight. Have a great weekend.
You too. Thank you. Bye.
We will be right back, folks. Stay with us. When we come back after the top of the hour news break, we'll visit with Melvin Dussel about the largest turkey fry in the world and Chief Ann Kirkpatrick of the NOPD. Stay with us.